Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to
Whoa!
Potluck.
And welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And it's the end of October. Happy Halloween, Rira.
Yeah, tomorrow's Halloween. I'm so excited because Halloween's my favorite holiday.
Do you have any plans? What are you dressing up as?
I have a Pikachu onesie and I'm going over to a friend's. I'm going to give out candy to all the kids that come and trick-or-treat.
Nice.
Yeah.
I am not doing anything. I am working on this giant-ass conference and show that's happening this weekend for collaboration.
It seems like it has taken over your life because if I'm correct, you edit like 5 podcasts and...
Yeah. I've been late for a lot of podcasts. Yeah, I'm late on
I saw a tweet, someone complaining about the K-drama podcast.
I know.
Being like, where is the episode? I can't watch the show without listening to it.
No, it's more that they can't watch the show, so they'd rather listen to it because Boys Over Flowers apparently is semi-terrible.
But it's on Netflix, though. They could just watch it.
Yeah. Anyways, we're going to be talking about our October book club pick, The Ghost Bride, just in time for Halloween, by Yang Si Chu, later on in the episode. But first up, I guess we're going to go through, because we're always experimenting with new forms and schedules here, because we're already getting into November, Rira has graciously compiled some new book news and new releases for us.
I've just learned that every month there's a lot.
Yeah.
And in order to like shorten them, like we have to do it bit by bit every episode.
So we're going to start off this episode with some book news and new releases, talking about what's coming up in the first weeks of November. So after that, we're going to jump right into our discussion. So first up on new releases, November Girl by Lydia Kang, published by Entangled Publishing, releases on November 5th, 2017. The book follows Hector, a mixed-race boy of Korean and Black background who escapes to the deserted Isle Royale on Lake Superior to leave his troubled home life behind. On the island, he befriends Anda, the daughter of the lake who's not quite human and summons storms every year in November that causes shipwrecks and drownings.
And that's November Girl by Lydia Kang. Lydia Kang, she also wrote a book this past year that came out, A Beautiful Poison, which was a murder mystery story set during the Spanish influenza.
Nice.
So, yeah, double deal, I guess.
Yeah.
By her books. Next on our list is The Speaker by Tracy Chi, published by G.P. Putnam's Sons Books for Young Readers, releases on November 7th. Sequel to The Reader, Tracy Chi's second novel follows Sephia and Archer, who are back on the run after having escaped the guard. Haunted by painful memories, Archer struggles to overcome the trauma of his past with the Impressors, whose cruelty plagues him whenever he closes his eyes. But when Sephia and Archer happens upon a crew of Impressors in the wilderness, Archer finally finds a way to combat his nightmares by hunting Impressors and freeing the boys they hold captive. And that is The Speaker by Tracy Chi.
Oh. Did you read the first book?
No, but I really want to. I really, really want to.
Is this like a fantasy sci-fi?
It's more of a fantasy.
Okay.
And it's definitely like a book meant for... it's like a love letter to readers.
Nice.
Which is why the first book is called The Reader.
Next up is Jade City by Fonda Lee. Published by Orbit, releases on November 7th, 2017. Magical Jade, mined, traded, stolen, and killed for, is the lifeblood of the island of Kekan. For centuries, honorable greenbone warriors like the Cao family have used it to enhance their abilities and defend the island from foreign invasion. Now the war is over and a new generation of Cao's vies for control of Kaikon's bustling capital city. They care about nothing but protecting their own, cornering the jade market, and defending the districts under their protection. When a powerful new drug emerges that lets anyone, even foreigners, wield jade, the simmering tension between the Cao's and the rival Ait family erupts into open violence.
Jade City by Fonda Lee. We actually, a lot of people from our forums nominated that book for our November pick, but unfortunately it comes out in November. So we're like, oh, it's not out yet. So
kind of tough. Yeah.
Maybe for another time, but it sounds really cool. It sounds like kind of like a gangster fusion. Yeah. Sci-fi book, and I'm all about that. So
there's a lot of concepts there that I am very much vibing with, so that's cool.
And the last book on our list is These Violent Delights by Victoria Nam Kung, published by Griffith Moon, releases on November 7th. At Windermere School for Girls, one of America's elite private schools, Dr. Gregory Copeland is the beloved chair of the English department. A married father with a penchant for romantic poetry and impressionable teenage girls, he operates in plain sight for years, until one of his former students goes public with allegations of inappropriate conduct. With the help of an investigative journalist and two additional Windermere alumni who had relationships with Copeland as students, the unlikely quartet unites to take him down. And that's These Violent Delights by Victoria Nam Kung.
Oh.
It sounds extremely timely. Oh my God. Did you wake up this morning and were like,
I was following. So I was watching the Dodgers in the World Series and trying to figure out, like trying to delineate between the Dodger posts and like the Kevin Spacey posts.
Yeah.
In my feed. Yeah.
Moving on to book news. First on our list is Hafsa Faisal's debut novel, We Hunt the Flame, was bought by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Her manuscript was pitched during DV Pit, which is a Twitter pitch fest.
Yeah.
The novel is set in a world inspired by ancient Arabia and follows a girl named Zafira, who must disguise herself as a man to seek a lost artifact that could return magic to the world.
Oh. I feel like a lot of people are jumping on this like Mulan type of like narrative.
Yes, I need more of those in my life. But Hafsa Faisal, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name correctly. I apologize.
Please correct this on Twitter, because.
I know that she is a designer, so she's designed a couple of book covers for Asian American authors. So
nice.
It's really nice that she's writing her own novel now.
That's awesome. Well, congrats to you, and yeah, who says nothing ever comes out of Twitter? Nothing good ever comes out of Twitter, at least. Next up is Soho Team bought World English rights to Samira Ahmed's Mad, Bad, and Dangerous to Know. Told in dueling narratives that weave between past and present, Ahmed's YA thriller follows a Muslim-American teenager who partners with a descendant of French author Alexandre Dumas to unravel the mystery of a 19th-century Muslim woman who appears in letters between Dumas and Eugene Delacroix. The book is slated for fall 2019.
Next up is Little Brown picked up author-illustrator Jin Xiaojing's I Miss My Grandpa, a picture book in which a child asks different family members about her late grandfather and learns his characteristics through the various features he's passed down to his kin. Xiaojing was the winner of the 2017 Little Brown Emerging Artist Award. Publication is planned for 2019.
Awesome. Congrats to everyone getting book deals.
Yeah. Marvin, can I be controversial for just 1 minute?
Okay, so I know it's my turn, but I feel like you can tee this up better than me because I have kind of no idea what's going on here.
Okay, so Twitter, like book Twitter, kind of went crazy this past week.
I'm reading this tweet right now. This is
I'm going to read it. But pretty much what happened was this white author named Abby Emmons went on a Twitter rant. Pretty much saying that diverse books are not realistic. And I'm going to read her actual tweet. Can I just be controversial for a minute? I don't want diverse books. I want realistic books. And that's written in all caps. And then she goes on to say, when did we start compromising real life for the sake of making our books, quote unquote, diverse? The world is diverse, yes, but not every place is. For example, if I was writing a book that took place in my hometown, it wouldn't be very diverse. It was written in all caps, if you couldn't tell. And that doesn't make it bad / racist / sexist. Real life isn't always diverse. The world is full of beautiful people of all different races, ethnicities, backgrounds, and I love everyone. But I don't encounter everyone in my small corner of the world. So depending on the setting of your book, diversity might not be realistic. I just wish we would stop trying to be socially, quote-unquote, correct, and instead just write books that actually apply to real life and actually reflected the kind of thing we encounter in real life. Diversity is good, but it's also unrealistic sometimes. And as a writer, I just want to write a story that makes sense. So
I feel like she should have ended that with hashtag White Lives Matter.
So
or
like,
something.
So like pretty much like authors of color caught wind of this thanks to Paul Kruger, author of Last Call at Nightshade Lounge. Mm-hmm. He is hilarious, by the way. Follow him at I think his Twitter handle is at not like Freddy, you know, like Freddy Krueger. But yeah, he was just retweeting it and saying like how white all the comments are and like how like pearl clutching everybody was. And it's like I remember going through the comments and it was like so shocking to me because one person said, "Oh, I write alien fiction where like you go to space and you see aliens. I can't just throw a black person in there." And I was just like, "Are you fucking kidding me? Like you're writing a book about aliens." And
wait,
you
were
can't...
they serious?
Yeah, they were serious. And then there was another person who said, "Oh, I'm writing a historical fantasy." And
oh, so they're supporting her.
Yeah, yeah.
This just seems like someone is like upset that diverse narratives is like the in thing right now.
Pretty much she's saying like, "I just want to write about white people and I don't want people to make me feel uncomfortable by doing that." And
I mean,
it's just like
no one's stopping you from writing about white people.
So it started this whole thing started like a not a hashtag, but like a catchphrase. Like a lot of authors of color started their tweets with, "Can I just be controversial for a minute?" And then they would like comment.
Is this like
on
is it. This a because there's been that that recent trend of like each like equals one like hot take or controversial take. Have you been seeing those?
Yeah, around? I've been seeing it on and off.
Yeah,
but I collected some of the tweets by Asian American authors, and some of them are pretty great. So we're gonna go through those.
I'm ready. I'm like strapped in.
So S.J. Jones, author of Winter Song, she wrote, "Woman, I live in small town. I live in a small town in North Carolina. What am I, a unicorn?" Ellen O, author of Spirit Hunters, she tweeted, "So I guess what she is saying is that there are no LGBT or disabled people in her town. Interesting." Sabah Tahir, author of An Ember in the Ashes, she wrote, "Could it be that your hometown is in fact diverse in many ways and you just don't want to see it? Controversial, I know." Heidi Heilig, author of The Girl from Everywhere, she did a series of tweets and she wrote, "Fiction is never realistic. Very few people meet their soulmates in high school. Very few have summer vacations in three acts with rising and falling action. Fiction is not reality. It's better. That's why we read, right? If books weren't better than reality, we'd put them down in favor of the day-to-day of life. So when people say, 'I don't want diverse books, I want realistic books,' what they mean is marginalized folks don't exist in my idealized version of reality. What they mean is my imagination has room for dragons and time travel and perfect kisses and long-lost princesses rediscovered, but not you. And of course, that's just more of the same, isn't it? That's what marginalized refers to. There's no room for you here. And if there's no room for your imagination for marginalized people, your imagination is incredibly bigoted." Dang.
Dang.
Fire. Okay. And then I'm going to leave it with some tweets by Tong Won Song, who is a literary agent. He wrote, "Can I be controversial for a sec? Write the book you want to write. No one is forcing you to write non-white, non-cis, non-straight characters. But freedom of speech isn't freedom from consequences. People will have opinions about your work, as you are asking them to do by publishing. Follow your heart. If it leads you to a bad place, don't ask me for absolution. Don't ask for forgiveness. You were taught, you were told. Own your work, tell the story of your heart, embrace consequences in the fullness of its complexity. Live your damn life."
I feel like that's where I'm at too, which is like maybe they're just not, like, there's a reason why we talk about write your own voices, right? Because obviously people who don't know or don't care to know aren't going to.
I think that if your town is extremely white, then you should think about how your town uses systematic racism to exclude people of color in your town. And a good book to learn more about that is Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Ng, because it got small town politics like down, like on blueprint. It's a great book. But yeah, a lot of like Abby Emmons, she deleted her tweet. But guess what? I took a screenshot. Screenshots are forever. I know that she like tweeted later on saying like how people were coming after her. And I was just like, take responsibility.
Yeah.
Like, no one's forcing you to write diverse characters. I mean, you can write a book of just about white people. I just won't read it. So.
I mean, the thing with ignorance is, like, everyone is a little ignorant of something, like, of some subject they're not familiar with. And once you learn, once you get corrected, or once you get, you know, like, once you are pointed to places where you can learn about it, the only real, like, course of action is to admit that you didn't know before. Now you know, and you're going to keep learning.
Yeah, right? I've learned on Twitter that people are, like, really bad with apologies. Like, no one apologizes for their actions. And if they do apologize, they say, I don't remember saying that or doing that.
I mean, Twitter is basically, like, social media in general has, like, really, really...
Apologizing on Twitter is equal to dumping someone over text. There's no sincerity.
I mean, not even that. I just feel like social media in general just appeals to, like, people's base narcissistic instincts. So, like, it's not surprising you get, like, some bad takes, you know?
I'm just really happy that the authors of color community on Twitter stepped up and really, like, made a great discussion on Twitter on, like, why that kind of thinking is problematic and, like...
Yeah, like, People of Color book Twitter was, like, I didn't know about it until we started this book club, but it's a great place for a lot of really interesting thought and...
You learn a lot.
Takes, yeah. Anyways, yeah, that will do it for our news segment. Let's get on to our book club discussion. Again, you can also contribute to our discussion by joining our Goodreads group. Go to goodreads.com and join the Books and Boba group and give us your thoughts on any of our books, including what you think about our thoughts about The Ghost Bride. A quick reminder that our November book club pick is The Empress of a Thousand Skies by Rhoda Beleza. The soft cover edition of the book actually comes out today, October 31st. So,
and also, you know, support your library if you want to borrow it at your library. Speaking of monthly picks, we want to give people an extra, like, 1 month time advance of
for
future picks.
Are we putting the December pick up on...
Yes, it's already up on Goodreads. So our last book of 2017 will be Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro, who won the Nobel Literature Prize this past year.
Yeah, I feel like I needed a reason to read this book.
I was struggling. I was like, oh, do we read Remains of the Day or Never Let Me Go? Because they're both books that have been recommended you start with when it comes to Ishiguro's work. But I thought Never Let Me Go would make for a better discussion.
Yeah.
If you haven't heard of Never Let Me Go, if you've never watched a movie, do not read the reviews. Do not read the summary. Just go in cold. It will give you the best experience that way.
Going cold to the book.
Yeah, going cold to the book.
Should I watch the movie first?
No. Okay. Don't do that. We always favor the book over the movie. No.
Do we? If you
can, read the book before watching the movie. I feel like the movie, the movie's really great. I love the movie.
I'm just giving you a hard time because I know you're so upset that I've never read any Harry Potter.
I think we talk about that, like, pretty frequently. I'm still appalled. Okay, moving on to our discussion portion.
Yeah. All right, so I'm going to play some break music for those of you who are in the middle of your commute. And then when we come back, we're going to start a discussion on the Ghost Bride. Hey everyone, welcome back to Books and Boba. We're about to start our discussion of our October 2017 book pick, The Ghost Bride by Yangtze Chu. This is book number 14, 13.
I think. What episode is this?
I don't know. It's been more than a year, but The Ghost Bride is a supernatural mystery adventure love story.
It's a blend of genres. I mean, for the past couple of episodes, I've been pitching it as a paranormal historical fantasy.
Yeah.
which I think kind of covers all the bases.
Yeah. For those of you who haven't read the book yet, we are going to spoil everything. So if you do plan on reading stuff and there are a lot of twists and turns in the story, pause now and come back later. But for those of you who, for some reason, want to listen to us spoil the story before reading it, because I know some of you guys are out there, just go ahead and keep listening, I guess. You monsters. The book, I'm going to read the description. So, Malaya, 1893. Lilan, the daughter of a genteel but bankrupt Chinese family, has few prospects. But fate intervenes when she receives a proposal from the wealthy and powerful Lim family. They want her to become a ghost bride for the family's only son, who died under mysterious circumstances. Rarely practiced, ghost marriages are often meant to placate a restless spirit. Such a union would guarantee Lilan a comfortable home for the rest of her days, but at what cost? As she reluctantly considers the offer, Lilan is unwillingly drawn into the shadowy parallel world of the Chinese afterlife. With its ghost cities and vengeful spirits, there Lilan must uncover the Lim family's darkest secrets and the truth about her own family before she is trapped in this ghostly world forever. Ooh.
So very fitting for Halloween.
So I listened to half of this book on audiobook.
Oh, that's cool, because the author, Yangtze Chu, she narrates.
Yeah, she actually narrates it, and she does a really good job with a lot of the voices. And the other half I read because I do a lot of commuting, so sometimes to save time, I just listen to
the book instead of the
podcast. But
I feel like Yangtze Chu's prose is very lush and descriptive, so it's very easy to like immerse yourself in it, whether it's like reading what's on the page or hearing it being read to you.
Yeah.
I guess we can start off with...
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. I mean, do you want to go like by act or by like characters? I mean, I guess we should start off with just the... Obviously, this is a period piece, right? It takes place in the 1890s in Malaya.
Malacca. Yeah.
Yeah, Malacca. In the Malaysian archipelago. Obviously, during the Qing dynasty, which is the last dynasty before the Republic of China.
And it's when Malaya was under British rule. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting because it's set in Malaya, but like the character Lilan, her family is Chinese.
Yeah, which is the case in a lot of the Malay islands, like Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore even. There's a lot of Chinese. It's like a mix of Chinese, Malay, South Indian, and
That's definitely something that stood out to me. Like, I just love seeing the blend of different cultures, because it's like also different religions and different superstitions. And,
but a lot of the book had to do with Chinese superstition specifically. And I definitely saw a lot of things that like I've heard before or I know before. I know the author Yangtze Chu did make some of it up to like suit the story and the narrative, mm-hmm. but in general, a lot of like the folk tales or superstitions are very, very like I've heard them from my own grandmother before.
I think like you can tell immediately that it's an own voices work, because like all the details about food and clothing and just like the specificity of it, it's like really astounding. Like I'm not a time traveler, and like I've never been to Malaysia, but it just seemed like Yangtze Chu did such a good job, did a fantastic job like setting the stage for the reader. And also, I would say the setting is pretty much the star of the book. Like, I would say that this book is more about showing you a different culture rather than it being a very plot-heavy book, although a lot of stuff happens.
Yeah, a lot of stuff happens. Like, a lot of things, like, it starts off, like, let's just get into, like, it starts off as, like, this, like, 1890s Malaysian Crazy Rich Asians, right? Or like,
no, or like, no, I, no, I,
or like Jane Austen type, like, here's how the rich people live. Like, here is like, you know, all the extravagancies of like aristocratic life in colonial Malaysia.
Okay.
You know, the Mahjong power scene and like the Grand Lin estate.
I guess we can just jump into to like the first arc of the book, because like the book is split up into I would say four different arcs, and
there's definitely four different acts.
Yeah, like, four different acts. Yeah. So we're introduced to Li Lan, who is she's a Chinese immigrant.
Yeah.
In
straight born Chinese, like Chinese but in overseas.
And her,
she is the only daughter of the Pan family.
Yes. Yeah. And her father, he has taken to opium, and they are pretty much bankrupt. And she had lost her mother to
smallpox, which her father also was scarred from.
Yeah. And she miraculously survived without
unscathed.
Yeah.
And they live with her ama, which is her grandmother.
I don't think not grandmother. She's like a nurse.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But the book opens with her father asking her, hey, what would you think about doing a ghost marriage with the dead son of the Lim family, which it's the Lim family, right?
It's Lim. It's the Chinese, like, if you were to ping it, it's actually more like Lin. It's the same word as Jeremy Lin's Lin.
Oh, okay. Lin.
Yeah.
Like, she's just like, that's weird. Like, I don't want to marry a ghost. Like, why would I do that? But, you know, her dad saying, well, you would live in comfort for all your days.
Yeah.
Our debts would be paid. And as long as you're, like, a virgin and don't, like, sleep around, you're, like, set for life.
Yeah.
But he does it. He asks her in a way where it's like,
it's not committal.
Yeah, it's like, if you don't want to do it, then like I'm not going to force you.
But then the Lim family does take an interest in her, starts inviting her to their functions. Right, they invited her to a mahjong night.
Yeah,
and then you get a glimpse of how the rich people live in Malaysia. Like they go in a rickshaw, they wear her like second best dress, and the Lim family is like a rich merchant family. The patriarch has like three wives, like main wife and like second wife, third wife,
and a concubine, I think.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting because like I think there's a line in the book where Li Lan says like, "Oh, we're Chinese, but we're not so strict as the Chinese. Like my feet aren't bound. I'm not like forced to stay in the house all the time to do housework." And also like she's kind of abnormal for like a Chinese Malaysian because she she's educated. Like her father has taken pains to like teach her how to read and write and taught her the classics.
It's interesting. This period of Chinese history, China was still very much isolationist. So they're very much like the best and brightest don't leave, right? So that's why you have like laborers that went to like places like California and the outside of China to look for opportunities because, and that's why I guess the rich people in Malaysia were merchants.
Yeah. And it seemed like the sons of rich families, they got their educations in like Hong Kong or like they went to Europe. And
well, that's probably because of the colonial rule.
Yeah, because
rule
of
too.
Colonial yeah. rule. And I think the setting, like Malacca is like a port, like it's a port city.
It's a port city.
Yeah. Like, and there's like a lush jungle around them. And I don't know. It was like, it was very like cinematic too. I could picture like the collage of like Chinese architecture and then like Dutch architecture. And then like you have like wildlife and it's just like this confluence of cultures. And it's like, it's so cool.
But then because of incidents that happened during this first visit, she's introduced to the heir of the surviving heir of the Lim family, Tian Bai, and also she starts getting haunted by her supposed ghost groom,
Tian Qingqing.
The first act seemed like a like what I would expect a Jane Austen novel to be, kind of like where it's like, you know,
it's leaning more towards romance in the first act.
And she like starts falling for
Tim Bai,
who's like
insta love, by the way. Yeah. It's just like, she's like, oh, it's the first man I've seen who is like relatively my age, and he's like good looking and smart. And yeah. I don't blame her. Like it's back yeah. then you needed to get married to like actually make a life for yourself.
And then she finds out that she was actually betrothed to Tian Bai, but because Tian Bai is now
the heir, she's no longer
eligible. Acceptable.
Yeah, eligible. Yeah. Like because her
family's poor, owes his family so much money. Okay, so during this first act, she is pretty much like everything that could go wrong is going wrong. Right, she's haunted by this like dick, this like really like just pretentious.
Who is like very single-minded, by the yeah. way. Like, he won't take no for an answer.
He's also spoiled.
Yeah, and he's just like, I fell in love with you the moment I saw you, which was like when she was like not even a teenager. and he's just like, oh, like, look at all of the riches my parents have burned. Yeah. As offering, like you could have all of this. Like, look at how great I am.
Can I tell you, when I went back to Asia last time, I saw like at the temple, they had like effigies of like smartphones now, like smartphones, Mercedes Benzes, like
what?
Yeah, like nowadays you can burn effigies of smartphones to give to your oh my God. Deceased relatives,
That's so
they
hilarious. Can have
smartphones, iPhones in the afterlife.
I was actually like kind of intrigued by the whole like offering burning, because it's very different. It's very different from like Korean funerals. And it was just like really interesting, because like she's like, I feel like with Asian ghost stories, it's the ghost is always like an ancestor.
Yeah.
And then like in Western ghost stories, it's like someone who like, it's like a total stranger who like died mysteriously yeah. in the place. So it's like, oh,
I think it's just culturally. I mean, the folklore and the like religion that the Ghost Bride is built around is kind of similar to what I grew up with, which is a mixture of Taoist and ancestor with like some Buddhism thrown in, kind of like a hodgepodge of like a lot of different superstitions and rituals.
Yeah, yeah. And it was like really interesting, because like she keeps getting haunted, and like she finally tells her ama.
Yeah.
And like her ama's like, we need to go to a medium. Like, we need to like get you right. some like prescription, like exercise the shit out of this ghost.
Because there's a divide between, because her ama is very, very much believing in all the superstition, and her dad is more Confucian and like pragmatic.
Yeah, more scientific.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, she goes to medium, and she gets prescribed like this tonic, I guess, like yeah. medicinal herb tonic that she's supposed to take every night in order to like
yeah.
block the ghost from coming into her dreams.
Because right now her main goal is to get rid of the ghost and find a way to marry Tian Bai.
Yeah,
right. That's her like, that's her entire like want.
Yes. And then we move into the second act, where like she overdoses on.
Well, yeah, we move into the second act because she and the reason she overdoses is because she finds out that the betrothal has been broken off.
Oh yeah, right? And Tian Bai is supposed to marry somebody else.
Yeah, right? Tian Bai is wearing like this like girl that she competed against in like a sewing contest that she hates.
Oh yeah, the horse face girl.
Yeah,
yeah,
which
yeah.
is very like, that's where I got like the Austin-y vibes from.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's like more of a soap opera soap opera trope, but
yeah.
But yeah, like we move into the second act, and you know, she
overdoses on this tonic, and then she accidentally separates her soul from her body.
Yeah, right. Pretty much she goes into a coma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A state of like not quite death, but not quite life.
I was actually very surprised by that. I didn't like, I knew that she was going to go into
the spirit world,
but I just like didn't know yeah. how that was going to happen.
I assumed she was just being pulled in somehow through like, I don't know, ghost portal or something.
Yeah. But yeah. Like, I thought like maybe she would be like granted the power to see ghosts, but she was like still alive, like kind of like a medium. But it was really surprising when she like became like not a hungry ghost, but like kind of like a wandering spirit
yeah.
who couldn't return to her body. And I was like, whoa, okay. Like,
yeah, so
took a turn.
So the second act is all about her trying to get back into her body,
yes.
right? Trying to figure out what's going on, get back into her body, and learning about the ghost world. So we, you know, she goes around, encounters hungry ghosts, encounters She goes into the Lim household to like maybe figure out.
Yeah, to investigate. And, you know, while she's investigating, she sees signs of like foul play.
Yeah.
Pretty much. I forgot the name of the character, but it's like the older sister of.
The older half sister. She's the daughter of the second wife. I think her name was
Yongli? No.
It's Yinghong. It's Yang Hong, but according to Yangtze's notes, it's Red Swallow, which is Yin Hong.
Yeah. Yin Hong, okay. Yeah. So like Lilan, when she is investigating the Lin household as like a spirit.
My bad, it's Lim Tianqing. Yeah.
I was right. Oh my god.
I remembered it wrong. Yeah. Lim Tianqing, yeah.
But yeah, like when Lilan was.
That makes sense because, in Chinese tradition, like the same generation, patrilineally, will have the same kind of middle name, like generational name. So Tianqing and Tianbai would be the same.
Yeah, we do that in Korea as well. But yeah, like when Lilan is over to the Lin household, she finds out that.
Because Lin Tianqing says that he believes that his cousin, Tianbai, murdered him.
Yeah.
Because he was jealous of him or something.
Yeah, like he remembers like drinking.
Which is like pretty projecty.
He was just like, I remember like drinking tea and it tasted weird. And then I was dead the next day. I'm like, well, props to him. Yeah, he probably was murdered. But when Lilan goes to the Lin household, she finds out that Yinghong has like the cup that was like the murder weapon. And she's like, oh my god.
Yeah. And then she somehow ends up in this other dude's house where she meets Fan.
She's like not a hungry ghost, but she is like a spirit that hasn't passed on.
Yeah.
Like
you know what I found reading all these characters? Like ghosts are jerks. Like, there are no good ghosts.
Yeah, especially in the Chinese spirit world, apparently. With hungry ghosts, if I'm correct, they're people who haven't had, like, a proper burial.
A proper burial. Their families don't offer them anything. So as they're in... So in Yangtze Chu's version of the Chinese afterlife, there's this limbo period before you get sent to the...
Plains of the dead.
The Plains of the Dead, which is the limbo area, before you get sent off to the courts of hell to be judged. So during this time, she learns about like how the afterlife bureaucracy works, right?
Oh, boy.
So she learns about like the first step is to whether or not if... you get reincarnated or not, right?
Yeah.
The first step is whether or not you go on to enlightenment, like heaven or not. Like if you get taken out of the cycle of reincarnation, right? So if you've been super good and saintly, you go to paradise, supposedly. If not, then you get sent to the courts of hell where you're judged. And depending on whether or not you were kind of good or like mostly bad, you either get sent to be reincarnated or you have to serve out your punishment before you get reincarnated.
Yeah, some of those punishments are really brutal. Like I was reading somewhere that like rumor mongers, they get their tongue ripped out. Rapists, they get boiled alive. I mean, they're dead, but like boiled in a wok. And I was like, okay, well, that sounds gruesome, but yeah, I think they deserve it.
And apparently even in the afterlife, the bureaucracy is corrupt and people can bribe and people can...
And some judges are unfair.
Yeah.
And we find out that Lin Tianqing, like
He's been gaming the system.
Yeah, he's been gaming the system. He's been bribing the like officials and like it seems like he has a lot of power because of his ancestors who died before him and who are still in the plains.
His mom burned so much money for him. Like his mom is pretty much like she's like very devoted to her son.
Yeah.
Right. She wants to give him everything he wants.
Well, it's her only son, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She finds out that he is basically looking for her. He's posted guards outside of her home.
Yeah, some like ox-headed demons.
Yeah. And well, actually, because of meeting Fan, the not hungry, but kind of like, how would you explain it? She's like a very selfish ghost, right? She wants to like...
Yeah, like her whole story is that like she was in love with this man and, you know, she died and he got married and had family.
Yeah.
And her like her lover has always like left offerings for her.
Yeah.
Because
he thought she might be a hungry ghost.
Yeah, yeah.
And because also because she keeps visiting him in his dreams, which is a ghost power apparently, and also might be slowly killing him.
Yeah, yeah. She's like taking his life force. She's like, oh, he looks good for a man of 50 years, and like Leland's like, I thought he was 80. What the hell did you do to him? We should talk about Erlang.
So through Fan, she learns that, oh, Fan can take her to the Plains of the Dead, which is like this limbo place where ghosts can live off of their family's offerings for a while before going off into the courts of hell to be judged.
Yeah.
Right. And so she wants to go find her mom. That becomes her like her goal for the second half, like for the second part. But also during this time, she meets Erlang.
Yeah.
Which is...
second son.
It means second son. It's more of a nickname. So you never really know his real name.
Yeah.
But he's a minor official of the heavens.
Yeah. Right? And he appears to be a man with a very broad brimmed hat. So you never see his face. But he's a very sassy official.
Yeah. He's very haughty. Very much like, are you not impressed by me? Right.
Yeah.
And
he finds out that something fishy is going on with
he's investigating the Lin family because like there's no way that Lin Tianqing should be like commanding demons. And also there are also other members of the Lin family that are like obviously corrupt, but he doesn't have evidence.
And it's also like he knows that they should have gone to the courts of hell already, but it's been like so many years.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's up? Like, I need to figure out like who is
so
like,
he's like he's
the
like,
corrupted official.
He's like heaven FBI, right? Or heaven IRS, maybe.
Is heaven more like IRS.
He's like investigating like embezzlement corruption, right? Corruption of like.
Yeah. And he recruits.
Or he's internal affairs. He's like internal affairs. FBI, IRS. And he recruits Leland because he can't physically go into the Plains of the Dead without consequences.
Yeah.
Right.
And he like gives her like a means of like summoning him.
Yeah, he gives her a scale.
Yeah.
And that's where she starts suspecting he might be a dragon.
No, she does not suspect it until like she actually sees him as a dragon. someone mentioned...
She never saw him as a dragon though.
No, she did.
No? You sure?
Yes, she did. In the Plains of the Dead, when there was like crow demons were after them, and she was trying to like get back into the living world, and he like turned into a freaking dragon.
Did he?
Yeah, to like slow them down.
I thought he was just fighting them.
He turned into a dragon.
Anyways, he's a dragon.
Well, like
apparently,
but like someone in our forums, I forgot who mentioned that it reminded them of Spirited Away, and that was another reason why I was like, oh yeah, Spirited Away.
I think Julie said that it was a non-irritating love triangle, which I agree. It was like I didn't like normally when I read like things that are getting into like romance territory, I'm like a little groany, but in this one I was like, oh, it's not that bad.
It was pretty light, and I really appreciated that. Actually, funny enough, I read an interview where Chu said in her earlier drafts there were pretty much like no romance at all, but like her editors were like, you need to put a little bit of romance in here and also maybe cut out like a lot of the food descriptions, because apparently she went like super overboard with the food descriptions. I got really hungry reading this book.
There's like, a lot of good food.
There's a lot of good food.
We can skip through some scenes, but she convinces Tian Bai to burn her a horse so she can take it, because apparently you can't get to the Plains of the Dead without transportation.
Yeah, because it takes a really long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so
She asked Tian Bai through a dream.
Yeah.
Which like, you know, she
Where she also finds out that he's pining after like a white girl, right?
Well, not a white girl. She's like she's like a mixed race Spanish Chinese, like Eurasian girl.
Yeah,
right?
Like Chinese Portuguese or something.
Yeah, something of that sort. But yeah, she's just like, oh wait, he said he loved me, but like
And then he also finds out that they've actually arranged for him to marry her.
Yeah.
Because she's doing all sorts of spying. And which is funny because, like, she's, like, the worst spy. Like, throughout the entire, like, the book, she is, like, kind of bad at spying. Like, she keeps tripping on stuff or, like, saying things she shouldn't say.
Yeah. I think it, like, in the beginning, like, she is definitely, like when she first realized that she can't get back to her body, mm-hmm. like, she's kind of like a crying girl. And yeah. She's like, I don't know what to do. And then she finds out that her cook can see spirits. And she's just like, tell me what to do. and then when she runs to Defan, it's just like, take me with you.
But the cook also is like, don't do anything. Yeah. Go back to your body. What are you doing?
He's like, go back to your body. And then like Fan's also like, why don't you go back to your body? And
well, Fan thinks she's a fairy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Fan thinks she's like a fairy from heaven.
It's been a while since I finished this book.
Yeah, which comes because that's an important plot point later. So Lilong gets Fan to take her to the Plains of the Dead, which starts our third act. Right, yes. This is the third segment of the story where she is looking for her mother and also helping Erlang with his investigation. Right, so he finds out that her mother is actually in the Lin Mansion, coincidentally. Through like meeting her grandfather's third wife, who is another jerk ghost.
She's very salty.
Yeah, who she finds out actually sent the like was so much a jerk that she was the one that sent smallpox to the family as revenge.
Yeah,
early. So she ends up in the Lim household as a cook, right, or as a kitchen helper.
Yeah, like as a kitchen helper.
Yeah,
and there she meets Auntie Three. And she meets who like her supposed mother, who is like the companion to Lin Tianqing's,
like the second wife of the patriarch of this house. Well, I guess he combined his house with Lin Tianqing's offerings to like make a super ghost house. She meets this woman who's like just also like just very seductive and very like kind of dragon lady esque, like very like.
Yeah.
Like.
Very much like a femme fatale.
Yeah.
And Lilong thinks like that's her mother.
Yeah.
And she's just like, I've been told lies my entire life. Like, I thought my mom was supposed to be like this kind, generous woman, but like maybe I don't know.
And part of that is
about my mother.
Part of that is her jerk third wife of her grandfather. Told her that her mom was a horrible person in real life.
Yeah.
Right.
And she has like no way to like confirm it or refute it.
And so as she's trying to like stay cool and also do her spy business, she gets found out by this old dude, Master Aoyang.
Yeah. Who she met on the road and like she like told him
everything.
Again,
she is the worst spy. She was told specifically by Erlang not to trust anybody.
Yeah. And pretty much, like, she gets locked up. Yeah. But she manages to escape thanks to Erlang.
Yeah, she calls him. And he originally said he couldn't do anything, but apparently he could.
I mean, he can't, like, physically go into Plains of the Dead. But, like, if she, like, summons him through, like, the scale, then there's, like, a ghost apparition version of him in the Plains of the Dead.
And I think it's also because, as we said, the Plains of the Dead is so vast.
Yeah.
Like, there was no way for him to navigate. So she actually helped him find the mansion.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And, she continues with, like, she sneaks back into the house.
She sneaks into the bedroom of Master Ouyang's
Yeah. Place, and, like, she's, like, overhearing, like, the conversation and, like, about how, like, the Lin family has been just bribing officials so they don't have to go to the courts of hell.
And she steals a letter.
Yeah,
right?
Steals
basically
evidence for Erlang.
Says, like, I guess from what I read, the Lin family has been providing weapons to a certain, like, the sixth judge of hell in return for favors.
Yes. Right?
And you learn that they've been using Lin Tianqing's, like, narcissism as a way to make him the fall guy, pretty much.
Yeah. Sounds very much like government.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, oh, even in the afterlife, bureaucracy is bureaucracy.
And again, because she is a terrible spy, she gets found out and...
But she escapes again.
Oh, right, yeah. She's about to get found out because she made noise or something, and then Auntie Three saves her. Yeah. And then it's revealed that Auntie Three is actually
her mother.
Her mother, because, and this is where, like, I figured it out right when we met her in the first time.
Yeah.
But then, like, she drops hints, right? She uses her real name, like, twice.
Yeah.
And the second time is when Lilan, the character, finds out. But
the first time is just like, how do you know her name? Like, you've never met her before.
Yeah. Which is like, you're probably the mom.
Yeah, you're probably the mom.
Confirmed it for me because I figured, yeah. And you find out that, her mom actually sacrificed her age.
Yeah, her youth.
Her youth in the ghost world to say that's the reason why Lilan wasn't scarred by the smallpox.
Yeah, because it's like, oh, like, if you were scarred, you would not have any marriage prospects.
Yeah.
And like, I wasn't going to condemn you to that life. But yeah.
Which is kind of an Asian mom thing to do, I guess.
I mean, back then, like, women's rights were kind of, like, atrocious.
Yeah.
So, but, like, she has to go back to meet Fawn so she can actually leave the Plains of the Dead. And she goes with Erlang, who is wounded.
Yeah.
And as
they're being chased by, like, these bird creatures.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It reminds me of Wizard of Oz, strangely enough.
Like flying monkeys?
Yeah, the flying monkeys.
I guess, yeah.
I mean, the book actually does remind me of Wizard of Oz a lot because it's about, like, a girl who is, like, whisked away into a world that's, like, magical and unfamiliar, and she's trying to get back home.
I mean, isn't that the Spirited Away part of it, too?
Yes. It's also, it also is reminiscent of Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere. It's a very, like, it's a trope in literature, but it never gets old because it's great. It's great storytelling.
So as she escapes with Fawn, Fawn now at this point knows that she's actually just a ghost that left her body, which is very important for a future twist. Erlang sacrifices himself to buy time for her to escape.
Yeah, he like...
And I guess that's where he turns into a dragon. I don't remember this part.
No, he turns into a dragon. I'm pretty sure he turns into a dragon.
Are you sure?
Yes, I am sure.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure.
So they escape back into the human world, which is where the fourth act starts. And then basically Fan lets her out in like this random door.
Yeah.
Which seems kind of like, oh, she's just being a jerk. Until you realize the reason she did that was as Lilan makes her way back to home, she finds out that someone's already in her body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And guess who it is?
It's Fan, the jerk ghost. Jerk ghost number one, I guess.
Yes. And Fawn has, you know, kind of not beautified Lilan, but like she's like taking advantage of her youth and body and being like, oh, you never knew how good you had it. Like, like I can work this body better than yours.
Right.
And Lilan finds out that like the marriage contract between her and Tian Bai actually went through.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, but I'm not back in my body.
Yeah.
Like, but she's kind of upset because Tian Bai can't tell the difference, even though there's like a complete personality switch.
I mean, like, Ama totally tells the difference. Like, she was like, so you like this, you like cold tea, huh?
Or it's like, you always drink from this cup. Or like, oh, you never wear those clothes. Like, it's like, oh, you don't like to eat that. Like, she notices, like, right away. And something important happens during this because Lilan can't go back to her body. She's pretty much a hungry ghost at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And because she's been away from her body for so long, because the Plains of the Dead, the time.
Yeah.
Time is a little bit different. Sometimes it's slower, sometimes it's faster.
And she's in like this fading case, away. Yeah.
In this case, it was slower and her body is fading away. And her apparition self has no weight. And she's kind of like, it's kind of like hard to stay
right
on the ground.
This is where she has her ghost kiss with Erlang.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The ghost kiss that grants her like what, 100 years of life?
In return for his 50, which is like, he lives for thousands of years. He's like, yeah, it's no biggie, whatever. Yeah. So he offers, and then he takes off his mask, his basket hat. Yeah. And then apparently he's like the most beautiful man ever.
Yeah, because he's a dragon.
If Erlang was played by anyone, who would he be in the movie version of The Ghost Bride?
I don't want to say because you're going to make fun of me.
Is this a K-drama guy?
No. Godfrey Gao.
I can see that.
I don't know. He just has like that rakish quality to him that like that would like play a sassy Erlang pretty well.
But yeah, so she gets, you know, this like super spirit in her. Like she receives life force from Erlang. And I guess like they make a big point of this that like he like probably shouldn't have kissed her for that long and used tongue.
Yeah.
But he did it anyways.
I mean, it was funny because like she had two choices. Like one was like to drink his blood and the other was like to take his air.
Yeah.
And she was like, the air, because I'm not drinking blood.
Yeah. So his life force gives her time.
Yeah.
And like substance again. And then she's able to go back and like confront Fan in her body. And then to her, right in front of her ama and her father, who like basically they're trying to like, her ama's trying to exercise.
Yeah.
Her, right?
If you've ever watched like Sailor Moon, like it's like when Sailor Mars like whips out her like her I don't know what those are called, like those paper spells.
Yeah.
Sutra, I don't know. But like she like smacks it onto Leland's body and that's how like Fan gets exercised.
Yeah.
But like the timing is pretty impeccable because the ox-headed demons who are looking for Leland.
Yeah.
They come right at that moment, and they think Fawn is Leland.
Well, because Fawn just came out of Leland's body.
Yeah.
And she's a spirit in this house. It's like, and then they take her, pretty much.
Yeah.
They arrest her or something.
And then Leland quickly goes back into her body.
Yeah.
And, she pretty much is able to live a normal life. Like, she has everything that she wanted in the first act.
At this point, she's back in her body. She met her mother. She gave Erlang the evidence he needed to, you know, to get rid of the Lin family's corruption and to send, you know, Lin Tianqing away to judgment. And now she is back in her body, alive, and she is marrying the man.
Tian Bai.
So,
and also her family's debts are gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tian Bai took care of that. And she finds that she is not the same.
Yeah, like she realizes that like even though she's really glad to be back in her body, she's like, I don't know, I miss being a ghost. I miss being able to go wherever I wanted without like people like being like, oh, a young woman shouldn't be by herself.
Yeah.
And like I got to see like more of Malacca than I've ever done in my life when I was like alive.
And then there's one more thing that happens, which is she falls down a well and
because she confronts Yang Ho, right?
About Yang Ho about
the murder of Tian Qing. And
his mother, Lin Tianqing's mother, like pretty much pushes her down a well. Pushes both of them down a well.
Yeah. Actually, I don't know how you read this, but it sounded like Lin Tianqing's mom was actually being badgered by her son into like burning him offerings and to like make sure the ghost marriage goes through.
Oh, no, definitely. He was like, definitely haunting her dreams.
Yeah, she's telling just to like, do stuff. Yeah, she's just like, I don't want to do this. But like he keeps like badgering her.
Not even that. Well, that last scene where she is attacking Leland and Yin Hong, she's pretty much telling her like, what did you do to my son? I don't see him anymore. He doesn't visit me anymore. Like she's gone mad because she thinks that they've gotten rid of his ghost.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
To me, like it read like she was being a dutiful mother by burning offerings, but he just kept coming back in her dreams and being like, I want to marry this girl. You need to like steal a piece of her clothing so I can get
the way I read it was she wasn't badgering her. He was like, but mom, I want this and I want that. And she was like, okay, I'll give you anything you want as long as you stay.
I guess that makes way more sense.
Yeah.
I kind of felt like a little bit sympathetic to the woman because I'm just like, no one wants to be haunted by a ghost, even if it's your dead son.
Well, she definitely did want to get to be haunted by him. But she was also like, I'm pretty sure he was stealing her life force. But anyways,
because
she kept looking older and older.
Yeah.
Right. And then she ends up saving Yan Hong.
Yan Hong is able to like climb out of the well with Leland's support. And Leland is left in the well, like knowing that Yan Hong can like just leave her there for dead. And she's just like, why did I do that? like it's like, oh, I should have climbed out first.
And then she calls Erlang, and Erlang comes and saves her again, and pretty much offers her like they talk about
how she's not
happy, right? And he offers her a choice to marry him and deal with his dragon family, but also to be like more than just a girl in Malacca.
Yeah, like he right. says, like, oh, if you become my wife, like, you're good. It's a very like solitude life. Like yeah. you're going to be living alone most of the time because I always have to like go undercover and do work. I don't know what time, like when I'm going to come back home.
You're going to move around a lot.
You're going to move around a lot. You're not going to age as normally as other people. You're going to watch people you love like die. And
well, that's how she was going to do anyways.
Yeah.
Because he mentioned that, yeah, I probably shouldn't have kissed you for so long because now, like, you're going to be young for a long time and you're going to outlive everybody.
Well, he, like, gives her a sweetener, right? Like, he tells her, like, well, why don't you marry Tian Bai? And then, like, if you can't handle it 50 years later when everyone is dead.
I'll come for you.
Yeah, I'll come for you. And she's just, and this is the end of the book. And she says, like, she pretty much decides to go with Erlang because she can't see herself as Tian Bai's wife and being happy.
And that kind of, I think that's a central theme. That's one of the central themes of the book is this change between from like, cause in the first act, like her world was just grow up, get married, have like, good life.
Yeah. Right? And I don't know. I don't know if this is like too much of a stretch, but I would say it is very like symbolic of women's rights in that era. It's just like, oh, like because they're not like living in China and the rules are a little bit more relaxed and women have a little bit more leeway and a little bit more opportunities to be educated, like they are able to see more things and more opportunities are being opened to them. So it's kind of like with her going through the spirit world and seeing all these things, she realizes that the life that she had before, like she can never go back to it. And not really something that she wants.
I mean, even in a more general level, it's like the more you learn about what's out there, the less you're willing to accept the world as it is. Right.
Yeah.
Like in her original life, everything was kind of done to her. Right.
Yeah, whereas, decided for her.
Where her travels and her like even her life with Erlang would be more self-determinant, right? More
Yeah, she would have to be more self-reliant because she'll be by herself most of the time. And like I think she realized by the time she like returned back to her body that like her entire life from then on would be to just be a mom.
Yeah.
And just seeing like Tianxing's mother, like she's just like, I don't want to be like that. And then seeing like the third wife and seeing like how much grief has fallen upon women who are under like men's control. She's just like, I don't want this. And I don't blame her. Like, can you imagine like getting married to someone and then like they just they don't give you any attention and they just spend all of their attention and money on other women.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sure it works in some instances, but like definitely like when your independence is stripped away, when you're relying on like the patriarch of the family for all of your expenses and stuff, that's kind of hard to
and it's like
hard life.
It's funny how they so they spend like a lot of time setting up Tian Bai as like this like kind of golden boy, right? He's like the good catch, right? Like you guys get along, he's charming, he's good looking, and then like they introduce like this, you know, this dragon guy who's like kind of more wild, more like more dangerous, right?
Yeah, more dangerous, I guess. It's funny because like Erlang was such a minor character in earlier drafts of this novel.
Really?
And like Yang Xingqiu was like, oh, I really like him. So she kept writing him into the drafts. And eventually she's just like, yeah, let's make him a main character. Let's make him a love interest as well. And I'm like,
at first I was like, is she going to pick this dragon dude instead of the homeboy? And at the end I was like, yeah, pick the dragon dude. Homeboy kind of sucks.
Homeboy is pining for another girl and he couldn't even tell the difference. Like I was like really like kind of disgusted when like she finally got her body back and she's like spending time with Tian Bai. Mm-hmm. And Tian Bai is like, oh, you should put your hair up. Like, you look like a schoolgirl. And I was like, oh, no, you did it. Oh, my God. You are such a jerk. You're a definition of a nice guy. Like, no.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the story. And I mean, what are your overall thoughts? I was very captivated. I was like, I didn't expect to be like, I was really into, I know you were into like the descriptions and like the settings, but I was actually more interested in like the thriller, like the mystery aspects of it.
That's
like,
very interesting.
I was like, I need to know what happened.
Yeah, there were a lot of plot threads, and I was actually very concerned, like halfway into the book, wondering like how all of them would be tied up, because I'm like, I know this book is like kind of longer than like a normal, than the normal novels that we usually read, but I was just like, I don't know, can she tie everything up by the end?
She tied it all up.
Yeah, and I don't know, like I usually like books that are more, I guess more tightly structured and the pace is like faster. But I really liked reading this book in a very like sprawling manner, I guess, because it was just like, oh, like.
It was very epic. It like went a lot of places. You weren't in the same place for long. And it wasn't, I don't think any of it really dragged.
I think that depends on your personal taste, because like I have heard like, I've read reviews where like people complained about the pacing.
Really?
But I think it really depends on like your taste and your reading preferences.
Well, I mean, people don't like diverse books, you know, like they're not going to enjoy the storytelling here.
But like,
controversial take, I know.
I think I wrote in my review that this book is definitely a book that you read to escape reality. Like, it is definitely, it's definitely a book where you read to enjoy the journey rather than like getting the solution to the thriller. And that's really nice, I think, because sometimes I read really quickly and then I'm just like, I just finished the book. But I felt like I took my time on this one. And
yeah.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it too. It's I would put it up there as one of my more favorite books of our
oh, that's
series.
Surprising. Really? I was wondering if you would I knew you would like it, but I wasn't sure if you would like really enjoy it, because because I knew that there was a bit of romance in it.
That part was okay. It was a little cheesy. I don't know. Maybe I just don't like when I start reading about their physiological reactions to
I know that's not your cup of tea. I actually didn't like, for me, I was like, oh, I kind of don't want Lilan to get her body back, because I like the spirit world was so cool. And I was like, I don't like, don't get your body back, like stay and like,
I mean,
explore
that was, those,
the world more.
Those were the stakes, right? Like that was pretty much the stakes of like the second and third act, which is like,
yeah,
will she like.
But I wanted more, and I wanted to see like the courts of hell, and I wanted to see I wanted to see the judges, and I wanted to
see. So you wanted the Dante's Inferno version
of
this.
I love Dante's Inferno. Yeah, I would want a Dante's Inferno version of this.
Book club member Jess also talked about how she liked, you know, the descriptions of the afterlife, coming from like a Christian background and coming from my background too, like just thinking about how the afterlife or your notions of the afterlife is also tied to your notions of your like real life. Whereas like the Chinese afterlife is very bureaucratic, because Chinese, like even ancient Chinese, like Imperial China was very bureaucratic, ministers and officials.
Yep.
Whereas like the Christian afterlife is more like kingdoms. Like you had one dude ruling over everything, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting how even this book they had, it's kind of like, Zensho's, Sorcerer of the Crown, where you had different versions of mysticism and religion governing like the mystical world, right?
Yeah. It was, the book actually, if you like reading about, ghost marriages, then I would suggest reading Lisa C's Peony in Love, because that is about like the character is also a ghost, and there is some kind of ghost marriage in the book. So,
okay,
but that's like Chinese, like that's not like Chinese Malay, so it's slightly different. But
yeah,
yeah,
And even in this book, the author takes liberties too. Like you mentioned, and she says in the afterword, in my version of the book at least, that the Plains of the Dead was something that she made up through bits and pieces of folklore, right? Like,
I don't know how much is recorded about like the Chinese afterlife. Like, I know like there's like records about like hungry ghosts and how like burning effigies work, but I wonder if there's like a lot of material describing the spirit world. And I wonder like how much Yang Zichu like invented or adapted, I guess.
I mean, the way that I always understood Rosado was it's a lot of folklore, a lot of oral tradition, a lot of rituals and tradition. I don't know if there's an actual, like, I don't think we have like a book, like Christianity has a book.
I don't expect there to be a book. It's just,
and also because it is like Yang Zichu's depiction of the afterlife, it's a hodgepodge of a lot of different beliefs, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's not pure Buddhism, but it's also not pure Taoism. It's also not pure, you know, whatever else that she used. It's like a mixture of each of those. And even within Chinese thought, there's different ideas, right? There's, you know, like even within the story, like there's the ama who definitely believes in everything, and then the dad who is more like pragmatic and more like.
Like, I would say it's like a very creative afterlife. Like, I'm trying to think of like other works where I've read or seen the afterlife being portrayed. And like, the first thing that pops into mind is Yu Yu Hakusho. Because I mean,
that afterlife was pretty much based around the same like folklore as The Ghost Bride, for sure, with like hell and officials
and judges
and stuff. Same with the Dragon Ball, like afterlife, you know?
Yeah. Well, we talked a lot about this book. I hope some of it made sense for our listeners.
I mean, definitely, if you have your thoughts about what we've discussed or your own takes on the themes and characters and plot of the book, please go shoot us a message on our Goodreads forums. There is a thread ongoing about this book currently, and we'd love to hear your thoughts and read what you guys think, because like, there's a lot to this book. There's a lot of meat to it. There's a lot of different things to focus on, to think about. And I love, like, that's the great part about, like, consuming media. It's like, you not only get to have your own thoughts about it, you get to see what other people think, too.
Yeah, I mean, like, look at Marvin and me. Like, Marvin's just like, I like the thriller and, like, the mystery aspect of it. And I'm like, oh, I just liked all the pretty details and food. And, like, it's like, I like the history part of it.
So that'll do it for our episode and our discussion of the October Books and Boba Book Club pick, The Ghost Bride by Yang Zichu. Again, our November book club pick is Empress of a Thousand Skies by Rhoda Beleza. And the softcover version comes out today, or the day this podcast releases.
And our December pick is Never Let Me Go by Kazuo Ishiguro. So if you want to get a head start on that, be our guest.
Thanks again for listening to Books and Boba. Please follow us on Twitter and Facebook, but definitely Twitter, so you can get connected to all the other great book tweeters that we that are part of our community. And yeah, we'll see you next time.
Bye.
This episode of Books and Boba was hosted by Marvin Yue and Weaver Yu, and edited by Marvin Yue. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of podcasts featuring unique voices from the Asian American community. If you like Books and Boba, please check out one of our other great podcasts, including The Collabcast, the official podcast of the Collaboration Movement, bringing you discussions about pop culture and the creative life from an Asian American perspective. You can catch Collabcast and the other great programs of the Potluck Collective by going to the website podcastpotluck.com.